So we are coming to the end. We've been kind of tracking really all the way from Daniel, covering this history of the Old Testament all the way up until the conclusion of the Old Testament. And then there is this separation. There's two of those on that whole outline of the Bible of 400 years. So between Genesis and Exodus, while they're in slaves in Egypt, there's about 400 years of history where the Bible doesn't record anything. And then between your New and your Old Testament, there's also about 400 years of history where the Bible doesn't record anything that happens. Obviously, a lot happens, and obviously there's a lot of things that go on there. If you think back 400 years, even for us as a nation, you barely get to the beginning. That's about when Jamestown starts. And all the things that fill that void in there is a tremendous amount. But we actually have one place in the Old Testament where we have a little bit of a glimpse into what those 400 years are about. So that's why we're looking at Zechariah chapter 9 today. He is speaking prophetically about 200 to 350 years ahead of time about some things that will happen in that space. So we want to cover a little bit of those today to understand what fills that gap between those things. And then in the weeks to come, we have a great study coming up for the fall that's going to kind of dig into our foundations as being a follower of Jesus Christ. So we'd love for you to join in and participate in that, whether on your own or in a small group too. Next week, we're going to look a little bit at Proverbs. That's always such a really valuable and rich book for us, and try to make that pretty applicable in our life. And then the week after that, on the 30th, we have a really wonderful opportunity to invite Don Heckman to come here and share both on Sunday morning and between services. Haven't had a lot between services all summer. Don has been a missionary with Muslims in France for many, many years, and has seen just tremendous things going on there. Without a doubt, if you are not in tune to the spiritual level of what's going on in the religion of Islam, there are more people coming to faith in Christ than ever before. So we hear enough in our news stories about Islam this and Islam that. I think that honestly it would be valuable for all of you to be able to sit and say, hey, give me a sense of what Muslims are really like and how do they interact with us at a faith level. So I have, man, almost two full pages. I don't think he's getting through all this stuff, but tons of great stories of people coming to faith in Christ, tons of great insight for you about what the Muslim faith is about and how to effectively reach out or communicate with one. There are actually many that are in our communities as well. You might see some of them around here and there. They tend to hide to themselves a lot, but being able to reach out to them while they're here is a tremendous opportunity too. So I want to encourage you, looking ahead to the 30th, to say, yeah, I want to be there for that day. I want to be there between services. I want to learn and kind of fill my cup and understand what's going on. So those are things coming ahead. For today, though, we got to figure out what happens between that Old and that New Testament. And so we look at Zechariah chapter 9, and we only had Alicia read a few verses from there. But if you look back at the first verse of that, you'll see that this is an oracle. In Hebrew, that's really a burden that God has placed on Zechariah. This is some insight into the future, some prophecy about the distant future he didn't understand, but he's been told to say. So the word of the Lord then is against the land of Hadrach and Damascus. And so as we fast forward from the time of Zechariah, just about 200 years, we have Alexander the Great. We mentioned him a little bit before. He's probably familiar enough with you, the great Greek king who rose up and within about 12 years conquered almost the entire known world at that day, a pretty efficient conqueror of things. So by this point, he's already beaten back a lot of the Persians, and then he begins this conquest of the land of Palestine. And so the first part of that is Syria, and we're familiar with that maybe from the news today, and Damascus is the center city for that. And so in chapter 9, verse 1, we see that there is a judgment coming over Damascus. We don't know who's doing it, but we know it's going to happen. And then right after that, we find in verses 2 through 4, a judgment over these cities of Tyre and Sidon. So if you look at the image in the background, you will see an aerial view of modern-day Tyre. They didn't have many aerial views in Alexander the Great's day. What you see, though, is, and maybe if you can back up, Steve, just for a second and remove those words, so then you can see it better, Tyre and Sidon. What you'll see is kind of this sandy area leading out to this rocky kind of point in the water. Does that, you see that? So in Alexander the Great's day, there was actually only the rocky island, and all that sandy area was gone. There was about a kilometer of ocean between the land and that water. And then on that island, which was the center point of Tyre, there were walls about 150 feet high. And it was a city that had never been conquered for obvious reasons. It's kind of hard to cross a kilometer of water and climb up a 150-foot wall and then beat the guy on the inside. The Assyrian army that had destroyed Israel spent 5 years putting a siege on that city, couldn't take it down. The Babylonians, who conquered Jerusalem, spent 13 years camped out around that city, trying to starve it out, conquer it, do whatever they could, and they could not overwhelm Tyre. And so you have a sense, if you live in Tyre, you're probably okay, right? It's pretty good property, pretty good location to be in. Everything's going to be okay. Alexander the Great gets there, and in 7 months, the city is destroyed. Because what he does is he takes all of the part of the city. It's a small part that's on there. There's some more that's on the mainland. And he raises every building on the mainland, and he shoves it out into the water, step by step. Tear down this house, throw it into the water. Tear down this house, throw it into the water. So what you see right there is a causeway that Alexander the Great built about 2,300 years ago. It's a pretty amazing thing to last that long. But that is the entire city of Tyre swept out into the ocean so that he could walk on solid land, or at least on the land that he built, to get to the city of Tyre and then put his siege works against it and tear it down. Ezekiel, another prophet from the Old Testament, mentions this about Tyre. He predicts this future with incredible accuracy. He says that all of the stones and the timbers that make up your city will be thrown into the sea, and I will make your land as a bare rock. So even to today, you could see this conquest of that city and the evidence of what happened all those years ago, referenced a couple times in biblical prophecy, hundreds of years in advance. While Alexander was trying to conquer Tyre in that period, obviously has a pretty large army and needs a lot of provisions. And so he sent messengers, one of whom he sent to Jerusalem, which is not too far away, and said, "Hey, my army is hungry. Can you provide me some provisions while I'm doing this thing over here?" The high priest, who was kind of the leader for Jerusalem at that time, said, "No. We've made a promise and an oath to Darius, the king of the Persians, and I can't break it while he's still alive." You think that made Alexander happy? No. Like, he's run over everything that stood in his path. He's about to take over the most complicated and challenging city he'll ever face in all of his conquering. And then this little city of Jerusalem says, we're not rolling with you. So he made a commitment there that as soon as he was done, he was going to get to Jerusalem and take care of things there. Had one more thing to do on the way. After Tyre and Sidon, he makes his way through the land of the Philistines. And you remember that maybe from David and Goliath, a longtime kind of enemy along the coast. That's the modern-day Gaza Strip that we hear a lot about, is kind of the land of the Philistines, because Gaza was one of their major cities. So all those modern things that we hear about are referenced way back there, the same kind of land that they're fighting over. It takes them about 2 months then to remove all of the cities and destroy and conquer everything in Philistia. And then he turns his eyes toward Jerusalem, and everybody knows where he's going. Remember, this is the group of people that took 90 years to build some podunk little temple that would fit inside this room. Right? It's not a really powerful group of people. They don't have a standing army. They don't have anything whatsoever. They've got a city and some rural villages around them. That's what they got. And so Jettus, who is the high priest at that time, is obviously terrified and comes on his knees before God and says, "God, we need your help. There's nothing that we can do. This guy's run over everything. How are we going to survive?" And so the whole city is kind of fasting and offering sacrifices and praying. And then they fall asleep that night, and Jettus has this vision and this dream that comes to him. Now, I'll tell you that the dream that he has, and then a corresponding one from Alexander the Great, is what is kind of shared by some early historians. And this is extra biblical. Do you understand what that means? So this is outside of the Bible. So I just want to be clear. right? I think it's a pretty cool story, just like we share other his stories. Whether it's actually totally true or not, I don't have the ability to figure out. Stuff in the Bible I have absolute confidence in, so I just want to be clear where there's a difference. But Jettis has this dream at night that says that he needs to decorate the city, right? Not prepare it for war, not put up battlements and all those things, but break out your best kind of holiday decorations, your garlands for Christmas and your lights and everything else you're going to do, and put wreaths everywhere and cut down all the flowers you want to have so it looks beautiful. Have everybody dress in their Sunday best, and the priests dress in their blue and their gold robes and everything like that. Open up the gates as wide as you can, and then walk out to greet Alexander the Great. It's one of those times probably that you're like, I'm pretty sure that's not God. Like, that doesn't seem safe, wise, healthy for me whatsoever. I mean, maybe God tells me to take all my stuff and run the other direction. I don't know, that sounds a lot more like what I think God would want to say to me. But Jettis trusts that, and the whole people of God follow along with that too. When Alexander shows up the very next day, he sees the city displayed in all this wonder, and then he sees the priest coming out, and he approaches the city on his own. Comes right up to the priest, and he bows down before him. And his army is just shocked. He's like, we thought we were going to take this thing down. Why are you bowing in front of the priest? He says, I'm not bowing in front of the priest. But before I started my conquest in Greece, I had a dream when I was considering what should I do about the Persians. And in the dream, I saw a man dressed just like this man. I've never seen another one wearing the robes that he's wearing, the blue and the gold and all that kind of stuff. And he told me to begin my conquest now, that Persia would fall to me, and that there is a God who would fight on my side. And I finally found out who that God is. Whether the fullness of that story is true or not, I do not know. What I do know is that every other city in Palestine was destroyed by Alexander the Great. That's what's recorded in Zechariah chapter 9. He goes through in exactly the same order that Alexander went through, Damascus, Tyre and Sidon, all of Philistia. And then when you get to verse 8, Zechariah records, "But I will defend my house against the marauding forces. Never again will an oppressor overrun my people, for I am now keeping watch." So whether the whole dream thing was really true or really not, I don't know. But what I know is that verse 8 is fulfilled and true. Because there was one city in Palestine that Alexander the Great left completely alone. And that is the city of Jerusalem. Historical truth, prophesied 200 years in advance by Zechariah. As the chapter goes on, we have the portion that Elisha was reading from that talked about the king coming riding on a donkey. And that refers to what historical event? Palm Sunday, right? So we've talked before about prophecy, and it's good just to come back to this because this is always so confusing. The biblical prophecy jumps around all over the place. It does not follow chronologically like we wish that it would, because here is something that happens in 320 B.C., about, and then there's something that happens in about 30 AD, and then we'll go back in history another 200 years behind that in the next couple verses afterwards. So it jumps around a lot. So here's a prophecy about Jesus fulfilled when he comes in on Palm Sunday riding on a donkey, and a promise out of that there's going to be peace that comes everywhere, right? In verse 10, this beautiful proclaim peace to the nations, his rule will extend from sea to sea. That hasn't been fulfilled yet, so that's way, way in the future. But then as we come to verses kind of 11, 12, and following, we find that war is being risen up again. In verse 12, we return to the fortress. And in verse 13, he says, I'm going to bend Judah as a bow and rouse your sons, Zion, to battle. So we had a promise of peace, but there's another battle that comes before. And there is a battle there, and obviously there's a lot of battles that are fought, so maybe hard to nail that down. But there's one defining factor about this battle that makes it really clear who it is. Because he says, I'm going to rouse your sons of Zion against the sons of Greece. And there's only one time historically the Jews ever fought the Greeks. And here it is. Happens about 160s B.C., and we'd mentioned a few of these things before. Alexander the Great's empire had crumbled after he died. The Seleucid Empire kind of rose up from one of his generals around the area that the Jews were in. And around 175, Antiochus Epiphanes IV became the ruler and set his heart fully against destroying the Jewish faith. He is the one that set images of Zeus in the temple, that sacrificed a pig on the altar, that did everything he could. And he began then to take that energy out into the villages. And he showed up in this one village of Midian, and he said, "I want you as the priest to sacrifice a pig here in the village." And the priest was a guy by the name of Matthias. And he said, "I'm not going to do it." But there was another Jew in the village. He said, "I'll do it. Who cares, right? It doesn't even matter. It's just a pig. It's just an altar. It doesn't matter. There's tons of gods. No worry." So he steps up there to do the sacrifice. And Matthias is so upset by that, that he goes and kills the man offering the sacrifice and the Seleucid, or the Greek soldier who's there to kind of lead those things. And then he calls the whole city to himself and says, "Let's rise up. We're not taking this anymore." And so a fulfillment of what God spoke about, and we have this whole Maccabean revolution, which is astonishing for a couple different reasons. You can see a description of some of that up there. And you can get a sense that there's a great disparity among the two sides. There is a Jewish rebellion that rises up that has no formal military training whatsoever, has no weaponry, no military leadership of any kind, never been to West Point, never been trained anywhere. They don't have any great weapons of any kind. They are maybe about 1-5 ratio arrayed against a highly trained Greek army. That has the very best training, professional soldiers, lifelong. This is their job. It's what they do all the time. They have the best weaponry they can have, including what you see up there, which were the tanks of their day. Right? When you don't have a whole lot of weaponry around you, taking down an elephant is really hard. And when guys up there have these huge long spears and these bows and arrows, the Greeks did incredible damage to huge armies with the elephants. And here is a group that arrayed themselves against it and began what is one of the first instances of guerrilla warfare. So a lot of what we even hear rising up in Iraq even these days about hiding in caves, about having weapons caches, about having secret training places, all of that was begun by Matthias, who actually died pretty soon afterwards, and his 5 sons, one of whom was named Judas, and got the nickname Maccabeus, which is the hammer. And so we have the Maccabean War that begins at that point. And over the course of about 10 years, this little squirrely group of Jews defeat this highly trained Greek army until they finally give up and they surrender. And then out of that come a couple different things, one of which is Hanukkah, a holiday that Jews celebrate, not so much Christians, but it comes out of this middle ground, because when they finally retook Jerusalem and they re-cleansed the temple, they had a little bit of oil left, as the story goes, but not enough to last very long, only about a day's worth. So they put it in the candles because they wanted to honor the temple again, and it lasted 8 days until they had time to find more oil. Kind of the little miracle of Hanukkah, which is why they give gifts over 8 days. You see up on our altar, we have a 7-branched candelabra called a menorah. It's found in the Old Testament as what they used in the temples of their day. If you celebrate Hanukkah, they'll have an 8-branched one. It'll have actually a center one that's used to light the other ones, so it's kind of 9. But they light the 8 ones to celebrate the 8 days that God provided oil. So one of the holidays the Jews have that came out of that celebration as well. In the midst of that then, there is this period of about 100 years where the Jews are independent. This is honestly pretty radical because in all of those Greek areas, there's really no one else that comes to independence. There's a lot of revolts here and there, but they all get quashed. This is about the only one in that time period that has any sense of maintaining itself in 100 years where it has its own kingdom, its own rule, its own authority. That hadn't happened since 587 when the Babylonians took over. And so they have this breath of freedom again. And that's valuable for you as you come to the New Testament. I know you're getting a lot of history right now. Hopefully it has some value for you. But when you come to the New Testament and you pick up the story of Jesus, right, who's pretty important for us, and you read all of the stories around him, you see a people who are yearning to be free from the Romans. In about 63 BC, the Romans retook Jerusalem and reconquered the Jews, and they were over them as lords and taking taxes, all that kind of stuff, for about 100 years leading up through Jesus. And so you can see then that they had tasted their freedom, and that's why there's so much hunger and so many people looking at Jesus. Are you the one that's going to remove the Romans for us like Judas Maccabeus did, the Greeks? Are you finally going to be the one that sets us free? And so that energy and those zealots that appear in the time of Jesus kind of spring from all of these battles that occurred. And this is a battle that, again, is referenced in Zechariah chapter 9, 360 years before those battles occurred. There is this God who defines those things. All right, so that's kind of what we have between the testaments that the Bible refers to. So let's figure out, what do we do with that in our own lives for today? A lot of history, a lot of mental thinking about things, which is fine. But let's look at least four takeaways that we have that'll maybe make an impact in our life. The first of those is just the clear sense, once again, that God definitely knows the future. It is not unclear to Him. It's not misty. It's not confusing. He has, again, with great detail, said 200, 360 years ahead. I don't think it gets any more challenging for Him to know 20 minutes ahead or 2 hours ahead or 6 weeks ahead or whatever. So as you interact with this God in your own personal life, as you seek to follow Him, as you seek to pray to Him and listen to Him, you should know once again that He does know the future. It's absolutely clear to Him. And so following His path is always better than yours. Right? How do you know when it's the time to open up the gates and hang out all the decorations and welcome somebody in, or when it's time to rise up and fight? Right? It's only the one who knows the future that can guide you in those things. And that's the God that we have. Takeaway number two is that obviously this Bible that we have is of God. There's no way that you can predict things, again, hundreds of years in advance with the accuracy that the Bible does. And we touched on that a bit recently. There's a ton in this kind of end of the Old Testament, a ton of prophecies that come that get fulfilled in that period as well as in the life of Jesus. And so we look at all those things and we come back again and say, why is it we read the Bible so much? Why is it we want to open up our hearts to that? Because it's of God, right? It has a power that we don't have. And so maybe you're not really concerned today with whether the Jews are going to beat the Greeks or not, or whether Alexander the Great's going to conquer Jerusalem. I realize those are not pressing issues in your life. But it does remind you that the God who has authority, who understood those things in advance, is the same God you relate with today. And so you come back to the Bible saying, I understand that there is a power and a wisdom and an insight of God found in that book for me. And so maybe even for next week, if you haven't been tracking much with it, you know that, hey, we're going to look at Proverbs chapter 17 next week. And maybe a good response is to say, hey, I haven't read much in the Bible recently, but this next week I'm going to read that one chapter of Proverbs. I'll read it with my family. I'll read it on my own. I'm going to read it just at my own pace. It's not really long or complicated, but I'm going to take it in because I know there's something of God in here, and it's worthwhile for me to engage with that. Right, and then in the stories that we have that are kind of referenced there, we have a couple different responses to opposition against us. And we all face opposition in our lives, and so we have some great role models of what to do. Or maybe not so great, right? We'll have to figure those out. So one of those is the reality that maybe there are enemies in our life that need to be honored and welcomed. And that'll seem just as off-putting to us probably as it would have been to Jeddah, the high priest of that day. Right, I want to fight my enemies. I want to build up walls against them. I want to keep them as far away as I can. But certainly Jesus reflects this too. When He was crucified on the cross, obviously great physical enemies and the soldiers who were nailing Him to the cross. And how did He respond to them? He said, Father, forgive them. They don't understand what they're doing. And so as you search the New Testament, you'll find so many examples of Jesus, of Paul, of Peter embracing enemies, of welcoming them, of honoring them, of giving gifts to them. And so maybe in your life, There are individuals who have risen up in opposition to you on whatever level. They're just gossiping about you in social media, or they're tearing you down at work somewhere and trying to make things difficult or frustrating, or they're attacking you in a family thing. I don't know. They're all over the place, right? And maybe God will speak to you today and say, what I want you to do the most this week is to put out some decorations and to welcome them and to open a door. And then there are also enemies that need to be fought and need to be attacked. I do want to be clear, though, because obviously we have both examples in this one chapter, right? One time where they just opened their doors and God took care of everything, and the other time where they fought hard for about 20 years and finally had freedom and independence. Which shows you how difficult it is to interpret the Bible in your own life. Just a good caution for you out there, that it's not really easy just to say, well, that must be the response for me. I mean, God really has to lead that. And there are times of welcoming, and there's times where you have to be fighting. But the fighting, let me just be clear, one thing on this one for you. This is the last time biblically that God asks anyone to physically attack somebody else. So there are a few distinctions between Old and New Testament. Same God over all that thing. One of those distinctions is in the Old Testament, there's a lot more of that physical battling. In the New Testament, it is conspicuously absent. God asks Paul to fight. He asks Jesus to fight. He asks Peter to fight. He asks the church to fight. But they fight in a radically different way. They fight on their knees in prayer. They fight in humility. They fight by being persecuted and standing up to it, but not by responding, right? Jesus himself said, if someone strikes you on the cheek, what should you do? Say, I have another one, and you're welcome to hit me there, and I won't respond back. So there is a fighting that occurs against enemies for the church and the New Testament people. But it's not going to look like Judas Maccabeus and his guerrilla warfare against the Greeks and their elephants. Right? Does that make sense to you? Right? So as we finish up the time here and I kind of prepare communion, I just want you to take those takeaways. And just maybe one by one, just kind of on your own, bring them before God and say, God, do you need to root me on this? Do you need to remind me about your authority over all time and just give me a sense of peace? That my future's in your hands and it's okay? Do you need to remind me again about the importance of the Bible? Are there some enemies in my life that you want to challenge me to welcome or to honor? Maybe I can't even speak to them, but maybe I can honor them publicly even when they choose not to honor me. And maybe there's some enemies that need to be opposed because they're attacking the people of God or the things of God or your name. And then show me what that looks like. So can you just take those, and maybe some of them will fit, maybe not all of them will, but hopefully at least one will kind of resonate with where you are in your life, and just let God kind of root through those things for you. Better than Jetta the high priest or Judas of Maccabees, Jesus is our best role model for how to deal with enemies. And there's actually a really personal aspect of that that affects us. In Romans 5, Paul writes, when we were God's enemies, when we were the ones that opposed him in our hearts and in our minds, Jesus chose to reconcile us, to welcome us, to honor us through his death, so that we might no longer be enemies, but be his brothers and sisters. And so Jesus comes to you again today. And all of us, at points this week, have chosen to be enemies of God. We never fully outgrow that or move beyond that. But Jesus comes back and says, I saw every moment that you were my enemy this week. I've seen every time your own mind and your own thoughts had your own authority and you chose your own path. And in the middle of that, I've given myself to you. So I invite you to come and be welcomed by Jesus and be honored by Jesus and have that sin removed, that you might then be able to welcome and honor those who rise up as enemies in your life as well.